This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating, and today we'll be talking to Stephen Phillips, author of The Metaphysics of Meditation, Sri Aurobindo and Adi Shankara on the Isha Upanishad, published in 2024 by Bloomsbury Academic Press. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, Stephen.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's dive in with you giving us a kind of a high-level overview of what this book is about. In the title, obviously, it's about meditation, about metaphysics, and about these two Vedantins, Aurobindo and Shankara, on this very important Upanishad. Can you give us a snapshot of what you're doing in the book?
The Isha Upanishad is a central Upanishad both for the metaphysics of a school of classical Indian philosophy known as Vedanta, which has legs to this day, and also for yoga, in particular, the practice of meditation aimed at a certain kind of mystical experience. So the Isha Upanishad is written in verse, and so it reads like a meditation manual, but it also has this a dimension of metaphysical reflection that is picked up by both the ancient commentator, or we should say classical commentator, Shankaracharya, who lived in the 8th century, and by a very modern yogin who writes in English, Aurobindo, who lived from, he was born in 1872 and died in 1950. So these two take the Upanishad very seriously, as have many Vedantins over the centuries. I mean, it's maybe not the most important Upanishad out of the 12 or 13 so-called classical or early Upanishads that inspire both Vedantic metaphysical reasoning or speculation and yogic practice, meditative practice. It may not be the most important, but it is certainly in the top few. And it's also quite short and manageable. It's only 18 verses. It's easy to get a grip on. And it has, and it's a high level of poetry. Some of its verses present what we might call koans, ideas that are supposed to help one achieve a higher consciousness by, I think, frustrating perhaps rational thought. Though I must say, both of these great commentators, Shankara have no trouble fleshing out the rational dimension and making sense of it all. But there is a very important doctrine of the unknowability of Brahman. The word Brahman in Vedanta philosophy is understood as something like an absolute or even God, though you have to be very careful there because there's so much sort of theological baggage that comes with that particular word. And when it comes to this is a book of what we might call Advaita Vedantic theism. Advaita meaning non-dualistic. Somehow the Brahman is everything or includes everything in some way. And there's also a theism, but we have to be careful when we talk about theism because we immediately think about the Western varieties, at least we who have grown up in the US or Europe or so on, the Abrahamic religions of Judaism and Christianity and Islam all have an idea of God as a kind of a craftsman or sky father, transcendent, but shapes the world and is very powerful and all-knowing and sends decrees from on high. That's not the Brahman of the Upanishads. It's something like a state of consciousness that's accessible that through yoga and meditation. And even the creative theistic part of the worldview is much more of an earth mother kind of creativity, a generative from within, or maybe the best analogy to Western thought would be Neoplatonism, where there's a kind of an emanation out of the one and many different levels of emanation, and as the Vedantins would say, of consciousness. Well, I would say that not necessarily Advaita Vedanta. Advaita Vedanta is only one branch of the very rich tradition of Vedanta. There's also Vishishta Dvaita Vedanta and even Dvaita Vedanta. These terms mean, first of all, Advaita and the non-dualistic Vedanta, Vishishta Dvaita Vedanta, the qualified non-dualistic Vedanta, and even the Dvaita Vedanta. I would say that when you take them all together, though, they are the central theology of Hinduism. So they have an enormous importance in Indian, in classical Indian, and modern Indian culture. There's a lot of skirmishes and back and forth about reading the Upanishads. See, the word Vedanta is actually a term that designates the Upanishads. The Upanishads are like the Isha, usually pretty short. The Brihadaranyaka is pretty long, but they were appended to this sacred body of literature called the Veda. And the word anta in Sanskrit means end. So they were literally the end of the Veda. So they are looked upon by schools other than Vedanta, for example, Mimamsa, Nyaya, and so on, as part of a sacred literature. Now, I think that Vedantins, particularly Shankara and Aurobindo, that's not what's important to them. Now, there are other schools like Mimamsa that read the Upanishads as part of the sacred literature and revealed truth. But Aurobindo and Shankara look at them as one of the verses, so we have heard from the wise who have explained it all to us. And you get a sense of Shankara and all the more. Aurobindo is sort of seeing this phenomenological route to higher consciousness is really what the metaphysics is grounded in, not in just some view that the Veda is holy and so on and revealed. So Advaitins in particular, at least those, there are some offshoots of Advaita that don't follow the great Adi Shankara, But for Adi Shankara, one has to not give too much of a scripturalist interpretation. And I would say, just to wind up this maybe too long introduction to the book, saying that I want to show that Aurobindo and Shankara are in agreement about the importance of yogic experience, practice of yoga, and so on. And their disagreements in metaphysics, which are serious, are not as serious as they have been taken to be. In fact, Aurobindo himself, in his major work of philosophy, attacks a view that he identifies with Shankara. But I think Aurobindo makes a mistake. I think he didn't read Shankara's Brahma Sutra Bhasha. He only read sections of Shankara. And there's this view of Shankara as a Mayavadin, as just an illusionist, as the world is illusion. I think that's wrong. And so I suppose within the academic community, the point of this book is to show that these two are much more aligned than is usually thought. And then, but really, this is an introduction to Vedanta, and at least one of the main strands, or maybe the most important strand, I would say, in Vedanta. And so it, there's a lot of wind up in this, so a lot of explanation of who Shankara is, what Upanishads are, what meditative practices within the Advaita Vedantic context, and so on.
Right. So maybe we can back up a little bit and talk about what brought you to this book. I mean, listeners who know about your work so far may know about your earlier work in Advaita Vedanta, but for a long stretch of time, you've been working in Nyaya philosophy. So why this book? What took you to this text?
Well, Nyaya philosophy, to make a quick comparison, is a lot like Aristotle. There is a premium put on common sense and explaining the world the way it appears. Whereas Vedanta is, in the words of P.F. Strawson, a revisionist philosophy. It says there's something wrong about our ordinary sense of self and personal identity, and wonderful experiences are available to us if we would only try and live in the right way. And that's what sort of yoga is for them, is sort of right living. It's not just meditation, though that's at the heart of it. I, like many people, I was first interested in Indian philosophy and Vedanta from a very early age. I even lived in a yoga ashram, when I went there when I was 20 years old, and interrupted my undergraduate education for 3 years. That's where I began studying Sanskrit. So, and I even wrote a book on Aurobindo. It was my dissertation at Harvard, and worked with Robert Nozick, who I think was influenced. You'd be surprised some of the views that you find of Nozick and philosophical explanations, how they line up with or with Aurobindo's. But then, when I became I guess after I got tenure, or maybe a little before that, I thought, my colleagues didn't relate very well, both at the University of Texas and in the broader philosophical community, to the mystical views of Vedanta. And so I found myself working in a little cubbyhole of the philosophical value of mystical experience. And it with so many, there were lots of different voices, Christian voices, Muslim voices, I don't know, panentheist voices, and so on. And I found the whole enterprise, so I thought I had something to very difficult. Where, on the other hand, in Nyaya being like Aristotle and also under-researched was both a lot easier for me and a lot more exciting for my colleagues, both in the philosophy department at the University of Texas and the broader community worldwide. I switched. But then, I retired and I said, I want to pick up my Vedanta again. And so I wrote this book.
Great. So I have questions on each of the chapters. I'm not sure that we'll be able to get to them. So let me say a few things for listeners about how the book is structured, and then we can dive in. So the book has eight chapters. Basically, the first chapter goes in and talks about Shankara and Aurobindo, and I'll ask you maybe to unpack a little bit more about, especially Aurobindo, who he is. And then the subsequent chapters take the verses of the Isha Upanishad in turn, including your translation of both the Upanishad and Shankara's commentary thereon, as well as then you append at the end of those eight chapters that take us up through verse 18, you also append some sections of material from the Bhagavad Gita and from Shankara's Brahmasutra Bhashya, his commentary. So that's what the book looks like. And I thought maybe instead of trying to go sort of verse by verse, I would ask you if you were to say there is a core to this Upanishad, a core to this book, where would you start in terms of trying to unpack? Because it's a dense book. There's a lot of interwoven ideas. Is there a piece of it that you think really gets at the heart of what's going on or illuminates really well how you see the relationship between Shankara and Aurobindo?
There are a couple of verses we might talk about in light of what you've just said. There's one about the Swayambhu,
Mm.
the self-existent,
Right.
and an argument that would have that as one of its premises, that Brahman is the absolute, is self-existent. And there is another verse about the nature of Brahman as the infinite. And then a third verse about mystical experience. Any of these three would be a good way to get in. But
Okay.
actually, I'd like to draw everyone's attention to what's called the Mangalavachana. Now, Mangala means auspicious performance. And so who knows when it happened, but each Upanishad, indeed, sir, at some point, every work of philosophy or poetry is introduced by a kind of ritualistic statement. Or usually poetry. And this one has a very famous mantra, which I think also appears in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is a little bit older than the Isha, so I think this was borrowed from that. And it goes, Om Purnamadaha Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishate. Now, a lot of what do you would call consonants and assonants. So it's a very nice bit of poetry. Om Shanti 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 is looked upon as a Shanti mantra, translating Om, that is the full, this is the full, from the full proceeds, taking the full from the full, it is just the full that remains. So the idea is that that there is a certain logic, using the word logic in an extended sense, not just deductive logic, but sort of the logic of concepts, or maybe the way a Wittgensteinian would use the word logic in a very wide sense, that there is a certain logic to the concept of Brahman as infinite that makes Brahman unlike other things, such that properties that would be impossibly coexistent on the same thing are not impossible with something that is infinite. And I think I mentioned even that Robert Nozick, the analytic philosopher that I mentioned earlier at Harvard, he really got excited by this idea. And he, is, along with many others, have pointed out that this is also true in mathematics. An infinite set, say whole numbers greater than zero, can be put in one-to-one relation with a proper subset, 2, 4, 6, 8. To infinity, whereas that's not true of a finite set of things. So there's a mathematics of the infinite. Well, this idea permits both of our commentators on the Isha Upanishad and many Vedantins to try to solve some conceptual difficulties of how Brahman being who's characterized as blissful in itself, supernally conscious of itself and of its emanations, can emanate, sort of lose. I don't speak for you. Maybe you have Brahman awareness, but I don't have Brahman awareness. I don't feel bliss all the time. And I have a very limited awareness. So how is it possible that Brahman becomes the likes of me and maybe you, I won't speak for you, and still be Brahman? So how can he both include everything and still have this divine awareness that is, even though it's not this transcendence of Jehovah, like in Western traditions, there is still some transcendence, some unknowability, and some speciality, even though we're supposed to be able to access Brahman through yoga and meditation. How is it that we have these claims, these metaphysical claims? Do they make any sense? And I think that this verse and the logic of the infinite, which is an expression that Aurobindo uses, gets us into the problem space of how there can be discoverable this fantastic super consciousness that is really thought about a lot, like Buddhists think about nirvana. There's a lot of similarity, indeed, with Buddhist views and also Jaina views. There's this idea of this accessible supernal consciousness. But how can this also be responsible for our world? I mean, I'm sorry, there's a lot of suffering in our world. I mean, how can Brahman put up with that? And how did Brahman get into this mess? And you can almost see right here the attraction of illusionism as an interpretation of the Upanishad and of Shankara in particular. But I just think that's wrong. The point about Mayavada is that, hey, there is a radical change that has to occur in the individual in order to share in Brahman's awareness, that the world is literal, and that's a kind of metaphor, it seems to me, that illusion is a kind of metaphor for how radical that change is. But Aurobindo, he doesn't take the world to be an illusion, I think he misinterprets Shankara as understanding it that way. But I don't think Shankara does either. I think Shankara is basically a certain kind of theist, an emanationist, an Advaita theist.
Right. Yeah. At some points in the book, I think you talk about a theistic monism, in this context. And so the idea is that what Brahman is in the sort of material cause of the world.
Right.
He
That's right.
is the world. But
Right.
at the same sense, there's this problem that, and so getting into sort of chapter five and the Isha verse 8, there's this problem of causation here,
Right.
because we have what at least it seems to be, and on your interpretation, Shankara is accepting the reality of it. Like empirical reality is not an illusion. There is some sort of world in some sense, and
Right.
how do we get this related causally to Brahman? So maybe here you can bring us to the idea of this, what you call the causal argument for the self-existence, Svayambhu. So we have this problem for Brahman. What is Brahman? What's the problem here? How does this verse help us with this in your understanding?
First of all, in this verse, we do get the idea of Brahman as self-created, Svayambhu. So if one is familiar with Western philosophy of religion, you know that a similar idea is present in some of the traditional arguments for the existence of God that go back to Plato and Aristotle and Proclus and through Thomas Aquinas and others. And it has often been said that, well, there's nothing like that in classical Indian thought. Well, there is. First of all, there is this premise of Brahman being self-existent. And then so the rest of it, though, is very familiar, I must say. I mean, there's nothing in particular, in particularly innovative about the argument as it proceeds from that premise. The basic idea is a combination of what's called in philosophy of religion, the cosmological argument and the teleological argument. And the cosmological argument is that, hey, there's got to be a first cause. And Aristotle had this. There has to be a first cause. So Svayambhu is functions like that as a first cause, as a first cause. Now, and then this is supplemented, not in Aristotle, but here. And I think in if we look carefully, we'd find it in several Western thinkers. This is supplemented by a teleological argument. Teleological argument says, look, this world is just so wonderful. I mean, it's just a great, it's fantastic. I mean, its diversity is wonderful. It's amazing. And it's it has, it might seem as though there's inexplicable pain and suffering, but we can explain it. We can explain why. It's because it's Shankara's defense is basically a free will defense, very familiar in Western thought, though it has this extra rub of karma, or maybe, I don't know, you might want to think that karma has some advantages over when you plug it into a free will defense over the standard Western free will defense, as Milton says, that Adam and and his descendants have brought evil on to themselves by their own choices. They didn't have to sin, but they did, and so on. And so so Shankara has something similar to that. He says, first of all, Brahman is a rational creator, like not like Dun Scotus's God, but much more like Aquinas's God. There are restrictions on what Brahman can do. Brahman cannot make 2 + 2 = 5. There are restrictions. And so Shankara says very clearly that Brahman emanates and oversees reincarnation, et cetera, independence on something else. Well, what is that something else? That is people's karma, their good and bad actions. So it's justice. People can't just get away with stuff. Nazis are reborn as feral pigs that everybody, even vegetarians, hate. There's this, Shankar goes on and on that you know the Lord does his best, or her best, we should say, probably in this context, that David does her best in trying to bring joy and harmony and beauty in particular into the world. But human beings, they make bad choices. Well, how did this happen? How did this get started? Well, there Shankara says, there is no start. He's a little different from some of the classicalists, exponents of teleological and cosmological arguments in the West, because they say it's not possible for this, choice. I mean, God created free will. Well, for Shankara, this is something that's just sort of in the nature of things. It's sort of like the Whiteheadian God, where there's just, I don't know, that's what the creator aspect of Brahman does. I mean, it's not really total creation in a way, in that it's gone on endlessly. Aurobindo is different.
I was just going to ask you, yeah. Aurobindo said something different. He said,
yeah, Aurobindo has a different view. Aurobindo does not like the free will theodicy explanation of evil on Advaita premises that Shankara has. So he has a view that's much like some 19th century and 20th century views that have a very progressive view about evolution, that somehow there's a telos built into matter that ensures that we get to some higher, better state of affairs. And so our lives are instrumental to developing a greater individual, which he actually calls a Superman, sort of maybe after Nietzsche. One thing that's really, you say, well, these are very different views. Well, but both rely on reincarnation. So again, even where they seem the most divergent, there's really a lot of commonality. And so I think what I try to do in this book is show the commonality. Now, I don't think I show that they've solved the problems of evil, the conflict of evil in Brahman, or the lack of bliss in my consciousness and in, people being oppressed. I don't think either one of them solved that problem. In fact, if I write another book, I may go on with this, the problem of Ananda in the Advaita worldview. Ananda means bliss. So how come it doesn't look like bliss around here?
Yeah. Well, maybe that brings us to chapter six a little bit, because what we've just touched on is this, there's a deep metaphysical problem involving causation, and it brings us to some existential and ethical problems about evil. We also have an epistemic problem, which is that Brahman is, as you said, is absolute, is consciousness, but in some sense we have this idea of ignorance, right, that creeps in, and that you and I have to, it seems, engage in some effort to come to know that we are Brahman in this way. And so part of what's involved here is knowledge, but also our desires, addressing sort of the way that we live in this world. There's a whole sort of solution here in both Shankara and Aurobindo that involves yoga, involves meditation, involves ethics. And I know it's a big, big topic, but maybe you can dip in a little bit and talk about how both of these thinkers address the epistemic problem of how we can come to know that we are Brahman, and in what sense.
Well, both of them understand the Isha Upanishad and other Upanishads Plus other works such as the Bhagavad Gita and for Aurobindo, quite a few other works, as the records of great yogis and yoginis who have achieved this higher consciousness, and they explain it to us. They give us. There's no record of who was the first one, and there's some disagreement about where it starts. Aurobindo would say that some of the hymns of the Veda express this mystical consciousness. Some outside Vedantins, some Westerners who have appreciated the yogic and mystical dimension of Vedanta have speculated that perhaps the soma in the Veda, which is maybe some psychotropic mushroom, may have been what originated this kind of speculation. In any case, both of them take paths to the discovery of Brahman to be laid out. They're not really innovators in that way. I mean, and that they both take themselves to extend a tradition of yoga and meditation handed down to them from the times of the Upanishads and even earlier. So again, we're faced with the question of, well, is yogic experience, the experience that comes through the practice of yoga following one of these paths and meditation, does it have epistemic value for telling us anything about what's real? Maybe it's just like, you know, some kind of dreams or taking some drug. So we're hallucinating. I mean, what is the epistemic value of mystical experience? That's a very difficult question. Like I say, it's one of the ones that drove me to become a researcher in Nyaya, because it's such a hard question. Now, in this book, in that chapter, I do broach this, right? I go in, I tried, I don't know, I read 10 or 15 contemporary philosophical authors on this problem and citing many of them. And the only contribution I have to the ongoing discussion in that area, where there are quite some interesting names like William Austin, and I don't know, some good articles on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, is that the sort of the upshot of the discipline in the subdiscipline in professional philosophy is that sort of pioneered by William James, there is a kind of inner subjectivity within a community that's reinforcing. Just like, I mean, if you point to some object, we're together, and I don't see it, you're going to wonder whether or not you're hallucinating, right? I mean, our basic idea about objects we encounter in sense experience is they have objectivity, and that's shown by their intersubjectivity. Well, intersubjectivity is also shown in traditions, Zen Buddhist traditions, Sufi traditions, Christian traditions, yogic traditions, and several different kinds of yogic traditions, and so on. But so the going wisdom among the philosophical examiners of this issue has been that, yes, there is a certain warrant or justification for holding these beliefs once you're inside a tradition, but they're not universally assertable. You can't claim that the truths that you have followed or found, even multiple times, different people over the ages, do not cross cultural boundaries. That's been the going wisdom. William James, he called it a piecemeal supernaturalism. He says, okay, the Christians have their sort of private, their universe, and the Sufis, the Buddhists, and so on. Well, I point out, and I think this is the only contribution I really make to the debate, besides maybe summarizing it in some ways, is that the mystics themselves are so committed to the objectivity of their discoveries as they put them into certain difficult to understand language, but nevertheless repeatable, etc., that they themselves would not rest content with that judgment. They would say, no, these truths that are discovered by yogic practice hold for Christians too. So it's not over, this debate. It's the sort of Jamesian piecemeal supernaturalism, or William Austin with his, Christian mysticism that doesn't cross over. We realize that other people can say the same things in their tradition. We just have to say, okay, let it be. You know, we're in our world. They live in a different world. We can't really communicate. The mystics in those traditions don't buy that. So there needs to be some further research, it seems to me, on this point.
Yeah. One question here about this chapter, something else that you've been mentioning in some ways throughout our conversation, is the role of hymns and poetry and sort of aesthetic experiences. I'm not sure if that's directly related to this question about universal accessibility as a solution, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on this.
I think it is related in the Invita context, both with Aurobindo. Both with Shankara and Aurobindo. With Aurobindo, it's very explicit.
Right.
There's an Advaitin named T.M.P. Mahadevan, who passed away not too long ago, as a professor of philosophy at the University of Madras. He wrote beautifully on the Advaita theory of Ananda, translating into beauty, seeing sort of artistic accomplishment as what one naturally flows into as one tunes into Brahman's creative energies, one becomes an artist. And furthermore, that by appreciating beauty, one is approaching the Ananda, the bliss of Brahman. So he sees, again, you have to sort of think of the Neoplatonic universe where there are lots of levels of awareness. And for T.M.P. Mahadevan's understanding of Shankara and the whole Advaita tradition, it's by appreciating the rasa. And there can even be negative rasas. This sort of aesthetic delight that gives us, it propels us, it sort of gives us insight into what Brahman is like. It's a step above our quotidian bruises and so on. It's the beginning of a transformation. Aurobindo says very explicitly that a person who has discovered Brahman or the true self becomes an artist. That and two ways. One, that his or her experience changes, so there is something enjoyable all the time. There's something, as though they're living in a fictional world where, you know, even Macbeth and Lear agonizing. I mean, it gets us, but we still enjoy it. There's still, you can say, there's certain joy in that the audience gets in appreciating Lear's agony holding Cordelia on the beach or whatever, right? So Aurobindo would think it's our whole lives become like that. That we really, now there are some problems with that, right? I mean, how can we sort of see what's going on in Gaza as some kind of drama? I mean, maybe he's trying to solve a problem of how Brahman can manifest in the world, but he's opened up some other ones as well. Yeah. And similarly with With Mahadevan's understanding of Shankara, but on the other hand, if you look at sort of the large, broad view of Indian civilization, right, that there really is this connection between art and yoga that many of the great artists in poetry and music and so on have this sort of devotional attitude, a kind of I don't know, a certain inwardness, a certain meditative attitude in their art. So, and they're, you know, it's not like Aurobindo is alone in this. I mean, the great tantric saint of the 19th century, Ramakrishna, said that his theodicy explained was that we're in the world is a process of saint making. We're becoming, but Aurobindo would say, well, yeah, but it's not just a saint. It's an artist. That's sort of the yogi is saint and artist, and I don't know what you want to say, connoisseur of art. So that is supposed to be part of the upward trajectory, in Advaita yogic practice.
Right. And so for Aurobindo, this is more pronounced, you would say, and maybe also goes in a different direction because of his being influenced by sort of tantric, maybe bhakti, sort of trends, whereas Shankara is not, he's not drawing on Abhinavagupta sort of things like that in a way that Aurobindo is.
Shankara, it seems to me, and I think maybe I'm making an excuse for him, and so are other interpreters like the one I've mentioned, Mahadevan, is Shankara, and by the way, the great Japanese scholar Maeda makes this point. Shankara is primarily interested in getting us to the supernal consciousness. Everything else is secondary. He's not really interested in what happens after that. What's the life of the enlightened person, the one that has known the self? He has some things to say, but Aurobindo has a lot to say about that, right? Whereas Shankara is, he's really focused on getting us out of our individual suffering into this greater consciousness.
Yeah. Let's shift a little bit to talk about the translations in the book, because what you've done in this book is, as you said, is it's kind of an introduction to Vedanta. In some ways, you're trying to make these texts in Sanskrit. Advaita Vedanta. Vedanta should always be characterized specifically. Right. Advaita is not all of Vedanta. But so you're translating these Sanskrit texts into English for probably certain audiences. You have past translations in mind. You include past translations in some of your chapters. So I wonder if you could just speak a little bit to how translation practices and maybe reading practices are involved in how you do philosophy, how you think about what philosophical treatment of these thinkers should be. Should we, always be engaging in retranslating these texts for new audiences? How do you think about your own translation practices? Just kind of an invitation to reflect on this. You've been doing this a lot throughout your career. You've been translating, and I'm curious to hear you just tell us a little bit about how you think about it in relationship to philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you well know, being a Sanskritist yourself, there are a lot of bad translations out there. Where, just to take a really obvious example, where the Sanskrit word jnana, which means something like cognition or even anubhava, awareness, is often translated as knowledge. And so then of course, you can have false and misleading cognitions and awarenesses that do not correspond to things the way they are. And so this will be translated as false knowledge, right? Now, false knowledge to people with a any kind of philosophy background doesn't make any sense, right? So there's a lot of there's a lot of tricks to the craft of translation, but we also have to remember that, this is not translation of German or French into English. There are a lot of deep cultural suppositions that are not on the face of text, and also pitfalls in not knowing how certain terms in English are read by a philosophical audience, like knowledge and false knowledge. So there's a real art in translating, where one tries to be sensitive to cultural context on both sides, both in the original and in the target language. And I don't know. I've often thought about writing a paper about what good translations should amount to. There's a lot to say on this score. I could give a lot of examples, but a lot of the examples are going to be peculiar to Sanskrit. And I don't know, like rendering locative absolutes, delineating when there is a dialogic form that is suppressed in Sanskrit by bringing that out specifically and saying objector and then answer. A lot of that's not done, so that I don't know. I mean, there are pretty good translations of the Isha Upanishad out there. I think Valerie Bobux is pretty good. I think that the one that's been the most influential for the Isha Upanishad is a Polish scholar named Tima, and I think he gets it quite wrong. Now, admittedly, it's hard to translate poetry and these old Upanishads, but I think he gets it wrong, and I think one of the virtues of this book is showing how he does get it wrong, and how, there's a tendency among Western Sanskritists to just ignore classical commentators like Shankara because they think they're biased. They think that Shankara, okay, he's reading in because he wants a consistent view across all the Upanishads, so he gives forced readings, and so they use that as an excuse to ignore everything. And I'm sorry. I mean, there's some really grievous errors, for example, in the Penguin translation of the early Upanishads. There's a famous line where it says tattvamasi, and they translate it as that's how you are. I'm sorry. That's an absolute error. And I've written a paper and I could show it right now. But in with Shankara, there's also the translations of Shankara's work, but they tend to be not very reader-friendly to someone who doesn't know, say, for example, Hindi or Bengali, or where certain, I don't know, ways of rendering technical terms in Sanskrit have already been established within the Indian subcontinent and so on. So I tried to do a little better job and bring out suppositions, delineate the objectors, and so on. I don't know. This is kind of a technical. This gets in technical area that's going to bore most of you.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, look, hey, Phillips, you've got a good reputation for this, right? Just let it stand at that.
I was just also curious about, the idea of translating as doing philosophy in the field of philosophy. To generalize, I think, doing a translation is not going to earn you a lot of credit, right? I did one for my dissertation,
Right.
and I managed to do okay so far in my career, but I think you wouldn't necessarily advise someone to say, "Hey, do a translation," and think that that's going to get you sort of have you be perceived philosophically. But it
Right.
seems to me like some of what you're saying is, well, in not just reading the text, but also in translating it, rendering it for an audience, you have to do some philosophical work. You have to understand the semantic range of these terms, how they're deployed in argumentative context. So I was just curious about that aspect of it.
Well, also, probably the most well-known translator of Shankara is a Frenchman named Georges Thibault, whose translation of Shankara's Brahma Sutra Bhasha, his commentary on the Brahma Sutra, is now in public domain, and I think published in a number of venues, and probably even available online. And it's a pretty dang good translation in that he has a certain eloquence. Nevertheless, I found several places where his predilection of his prejudice in favor of Ramanujas, he says it very explicitly in his introduction, that he thinks Ramanuja is right on these contested readings of certain sutras in the Brahma Sutra. And it shows. And if you're not aware of that, I mean, I hopefully I try to bracket his bias as much as I can. Everyone has some biases, but I'm shocked by some ways that translators have shaped philosophical views. So indeed, you do have to be very careful to be a Madhyastha, to be the sort of umpire who's trying to faithfully render views, which requires contextualization and delineation of semantic range and so on, and being straightforward about how there are different interpretations of certain, particularly these old Upanishads. So yeah, and then. Yeah, if you don't think, here's another very important point. If you don't think with the text philosophically, you're not going to get it. I mean, when Shankara is being explicit in giving a philosophical argument and you don't understand what it is to have a cosmological or teleological argument or what an argument is, you're not going to be able to follow Shankara. The same with Aurobindo. So surely, yes. I mean, I don't think that people without philosophical training can do a good job translating any classical Indian philosophy or Aurobindo for that matter. You got to have a sense of, not just an argument that has certain premises and a conclusion, but a sort of, argument in a very broad sense. How a picture is painted that takes in various kinds of evidence that block certain untoward consequences and so on. If one's not, I don't know, talented or at least trained in following out consequences of positions and presuppositions and so on, there's very little in Sanskrit philosophy or a bit of that's going to be comprehensible.
Yeah. Well, I've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you so much for talking about this book with me. What are you working on now? This book has came out in January, so presumably you're on other topics or projects.
Yeah, well, I wrote a book that's coming out in a Bloomsbury Research volume in India on the late Vedantin, Advaita Vedantin called Dharmaraja. It was really curious. I think I sent you the paper where he combines Advaita Vedanta and Nyaya. And I found that very interesting. It's as though, I mean, these two schools of thought have been loggerheads for centuries, and here we find a pre-modern philosopher, pre-European influence, finding a sort of middle ground between the two positions and incorporating a lot of Nyaya into Advaita Vedanta. So I wrote that paper. And then I have sketched out another book, this sort of problem of Ananda and this world, the theodicy, let us say, the explanation of evil or of suffering on Advaita premises, I think is very interesting. And I've sort of sketched out another book on this, which will have a lot to do with the philosophy of beauty and that TMP Mahadevan that I talked about, where and this whole tradition of aesthetic experience of rasa as an intermediary, as an elevation, as a kind of yoga, as an elevation, as a part of our meditative discipline, and also in as you know, as Aurobindo would say, that the yogi does become an artist. This is also a view in Kashmiri Shaivism that's pronounced. Yeah, that's, and as you know, there's a lot to say about rasa and then the aesthetic tradition and how it gets incorporated. I have a lot of research. There's a person named Appiah Dixita, who was both a great aesthete and a great Advaita Vedanta, and some others who've done some work in this area that I still have some research to do in those.
We read Appiah Dixita in graduate school. That's what started me off on my Ankara kick. I
Oh,
don't know if
really?
you remember that. Yeah, years ago. So I'll have to dig out my notes. We'll talk about that after the interview. But yes,
Okay.
looking
Okay.
forward to hearing how that project goes and maybe talking with you in the future. So
Okay.
thanks for your time, Stephen.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.